Good afternoon, Eastern Washington. This is Matt Shea, and welcome to Patriot Radio, broadcasting live from the capital of Free Washington, Spokane Valley, also formerly known as Opportunity, and brought to you once again by the committee to elect Matt Shea Republican and the legacy of Dr. Stan Monteith, bringing you the story behind the story and the news behind the news. And once again, this is the year we make freedom a reality, because our hope is not in man, but in Jesus Christ. But we can't end in prayer. We must also move to action. And as Jeremiah 6:16 reminds us, stand at the crossroads and look, ask for the ancient paths, ask where the good way is, and walk in it. You will find rest for your souls. There is a lot in the news today, and a couple very disturbing things. One, there is a standoff happening in North Dakota, and I will get to that here in a bit, but it has dramatically escalated now that we're getting reports the National Guard is going to be called in. So I'm going to get to that here in a bit. I've got literally information rolling in as we're doing the show right now. But now from the front, your daily intelligence briefing on the international front, the G20 conference, and ominously, the Chinese president saying before he, I should say premier, before he left, says this, quote, "We live in turbulent times," end quote. A lot of people taking shots at Obama while he was there at the G20 summit. Also, interestingly enough, many countries actually coming out, not just taking shots at Obama, but actually calling him names and disrespecting him because they see America as weak right now. Thanks, of course, to his leadership. It's also curious that the rest of the world doesn't even really take what the United States is suggesting anymore at face value. Very curious how quickly everything over the last 8 years has devolved with the massive lack of leadership in Washington, D.C. In fact, some people predicted that this is what would happen, and indeed, that is what is happening. And all I think that this underscores for us is that we have to vote in November. And if you're of the millennial generation, go find the truth. Obama, Clinton, it's globalism, and it's the control of your everyday lives. It's not going to end unless we show up and we participate and we vote. And then we come up afterwards to our elected representatives. We give them the ideas that we have in shrinking government, and we stand side by side with them when they do make those decisions. So when they get savaged by the mainstream media and people associated with communists and the Muslim Brotherhood, that they don't cower because they know the people are behind them. They don't compromise. They don't waffle. But they're emboldened because we're all standing together, united in the defense of freedom and liberty. And that's why, to me, and that's why I keep bringing up the Polish militias, because it is such an encouraging story of what happens when you actually get back to the basics. You know, in the Washington State Constitution, Article 10, every able-bodied man between the ages of 18 and 45 is liable for militia service. And, you know, the Polish militias got their ideas from us. And now it's becoming a geostrategic deterrent to Russian aggression in Poland and also in the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. You know, the cure is just to be Americans again. Weakness emboldens our enemies. And just get back to the basic principles, the fundamental principles. And if we don't, things are going to continue in the direction they're going, which is not good, which brings us to the seventh largest container shipper in the entire world, Hanjin, declaring bankruptcy. Literally now, ships and loads locked at the ports. They can't unload them until they get the bankruptcy stuff figured out. And I brought this up a couple years ago. You know, the port in Tacoma, they electrified it, and I asked what happens if the power goes out. Well, it wasn't the power that went out. It was the longshoremen who struck, and now people are avoiding our ports altogether. And this is all on top of the fact that the Baltic Dry Index has been in the tank for a while now. The Baltic Dry Index measures shipping between countries and between continents. And so this should not, I guess, surprise anybody that this is happening. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, this is kind of getting dramatic. And everybody keeps saying that the economy is doing well. It's really some indicators, direct, clear indicators to the contrary. Also want to mention on the international front, this report, and it was actually corroborated by a couple news outlets until a couple of days ago, that the Eastern European hacker known as Guccifer, that he had committed suicide. That is a hoax. It's not true. But there were several media outlets that picked this up and just got debunked. So still alive, not dead yet. And this is the same hacker who was allegedly associated with hacking Hillary Clinton's emails. So very interesting, all the disinformation going on in that sphere, in that realm. On the national front, once again, thoughts and prayers out to the family of Phyllis Schlafly, a conservative icon, somebody who kept the fight up literally to their last day on earth. I think kind of a model for all of us to keep fighting till the bell sounds, till we're called home. And some people on the left, you know, and this is the tolerant left, and we got to call them out on this kind of stuff. Some people on the left took to Twitter savaging, glad she was dead, and just some horrific things. And, you know, we need to not return that in kind. We need to rise above it. But it just goes to show you that the tolerant left really isn't that tolerant, and they're really not that peaceful, by the way. And really never have been. I mean, you know, the socialist Marxist communist movement is responsible for the deaths of more people than any other attempted form of government in the history of the world. You're talking over 100 million people, and that's by the conservative estimates. Unreal. But we just call them out on that, and every time they do it, there you go. But I think we don't want it to tarnish or take away from Phyllis's memory. I mean, she did a lot for this country and did a lot for the conservative movement. Actually turned the party in the right direction. Also on the national front, something people are not hearing about, knife jihad happening not only in Europe, but now, as we reported last week, in Roanoke, Virginia. And not making the news. So now we're having terrorist attacks that aren't even making the news because apparently that's the new norm. Unreal. Also on the national front, the election hack in Illinois and Arizona. Now sitting congressmen, congresswomen, and senators being briefed that the Russians are intending to do something to influence, hack our election coming up. In the DHS, Department of Homeland Security needs to be the one to oversee all the elections because they are, quote, a critical infrastructure. I don't believe that DHS in charge of our elections, when things are so contentious right now, and when Obama and Hillary Clinton both have used the organs of government for their own personal gain and to persecute political adversaries. Makes me uneasy. Probably makes you uneasy too. Also on the national front, the debt at $19.5 trillion. $1 trillion, getting to a point where we can't even pay it back. What's the solution? Smaller government, free markets, and getting out of the cycle of debt. Don't raise the debt ceiling again. We don't need to. We need to make the hard decisions now, and that really is a message to our representatives in Washington, D.C. Also on the national front, North Dakota. The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe . This is the successor to the Great Sioux Tribe, is in a direct standoff right now with law enforcement and apparently the federal government. Now, the pipeline that's going through apparently is in violation of treaty rights. And originally, this was a protest. They were literally having people block the construction of the pipeline. Here's the curious part. Now we're getting reports that the governor is calling in the National Guard to remove them. Now, Indian tribes that are federally recognized are actually sovereign nations. However, as part of the treaties that were signed, they have full constitutional rights. And here's the other interesting part about all of this. The federal government is basically saying, whatever. So not only are they invading the sovereignty of our states, but they're actually now invading a sovereign nation and their rights and violating treaty rights, saying, whatever, we're going to start building this pipeline. And now we're going to remove you with the military. This is the kind of escalation that we have been talking about, and it's interesting, too, that CNN barely picked this up. Most of the mainstream media is not even reporting about this at all, and we're going to continue to report about this because it is just another example of property rights not really being property rights when somebody in the government thinks they need it more than you do. In fact, we're going to be talking about that today with my guest. But take a look at it for yourself. Take a look at it for yourself. This Dakota Access Pipeline. And what they're claiming is specifically, okay, in their own statement, and this came from the Red Rock Sioux Tribe, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. But the Army Corps has ignored all the laws and fast-tracked this massive project just to meet the pipeline's aggressive construction schedule. So in other words, all the rules and everything that these federal agencies put in place, right, for everybody, including themselves, they suddenly don't apply. I ran into this in the central part of the state where some bureaucrat tried to apply a law that applies to the agencies. It actually limits the scope of the agencies, but tried to apply it to the public. And this is the kind of thing that's going on. They literally, these rules are great for everybody but them. And this is where another example of government above the law. So we're going to keep our eyes on this. We'll be talking about it quite a bit in the following weeks, because this is just another escalation in the war on rural America and the war on the West. On the regional front, the McCurvin ranching family up in Northeast Washington fully vindicated when this professor, Robert Weiglis, at Washington State University was forced to admit that his so-called results of his scientific study that showed, number one, that the participants of that study did not lose any livestock. That was a false statement. That was the first. And secondly, his statement to the press that the McCurvin family released cattle intentionally on top of a wolf den, when in fact they actually released it about 4 miles away on an allotment that they had to release it on as part of their management plan and their allotment plan. WSU now is distancing themselves from this professor. But here's the problem I've got with this. You have a professor who intentionally, with knowledge ahead of time, lied to smear this family. To smear them. As part of his agenda, twisted the facts to fit his own conclusions. Didn't really do true science. And he's supposedly the director of the large carnivore conservation section there at WSU. And here's the bigger problem I've got with this, all that. If this was somebody on the conservative side of the spectrum, believe me, they would be calling for the resignation. Well, you know what? We need to call for his resignation. He intentionally lied as a scientist. Anything that he does going forward, who can trust it? Because he's doing it only for the sake of his agenda, which is to run ranchers and farmers, apparently, off their land by making stuff up like this so that this poor family gets so many death threats they have to shut their phone off. I really don't think we can let them get away with this kind of stuff. We need to hold these people accountable. And so I'm going to be posting on Facebook an action alert here over the next 2 days. And I would encourage you, call down there and demand his resignation. This just can't stand, because if we allow it to stand, how do we know he's not going to do that and fudge the numbers in the future to fit his radical environmentalist agenda? We don't. On the flip side, the University of Washington actually did a scientific study and came out with an outcome and a conclusion that minimum wage increases destroy jobs. So despite the fact that it went against what the agenda is there in downtown Seattle, they came out with the truth. And that's the way science should be. It's the way it should be. Also on the regional front, 2 more days if you want to get your ideas in for the Liberty State flag, the 51st state movement here in eastern Washington, moving ahead full steam. I actually just got the maps today for the official bill. So take a look at it. Come up with your ideas and post it up on Facebook at Patriot Radio US. Also on the regional front, the Attorney General for the state of Washington, Bob Ferguson, comes out with a proposal to ban, quote, assault weapons. There's no such thing as an assault weapon, by the way, but that's what he said. Assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Folks, this was proposed here 2 days ago. I posted it up there as an action alert to call his office, melt the phone lines down, send emails as well. But this underscores the importance of the election coming up at the state house level, that we need to get people elected at the state house level who are going to hold the line on the right to bear arms. Folks, this is what they're coming for next. They got health care. They're on the verge of getting cap and trade. And now they're going after guns. And we said this was going to happen, but they are literally doing it now. And right here in Washington, we're 2 votes away from a majority in the state house here in Washington. A lot of people don't know that. One of those seats we won already in the primary. Looks like the numbers are almost 60% right now. Looks like he's gonna win in the general. That means we're tied, folks. We are 1 vote from being a majority to stop this kind of garbage. But this assault weapons ban, so-called, because people don't know what that word even means on the left. There's a couple points here. First, we need to do everything we can to fight within the system. But I'm telling you right now, if they try to come for our guns, I will be the first one to stand up. In fact, I'm going to post it online. I'm not going to comply. You can come and take it from me, because that is a right that once it's gone, you can't defend any of the other rights. And that's the line in the sand. That is the line in the sand, and it should be for all of us. We did not have our forefathers come to this country, fight for freedom, die for freedom, to be subjugated by socialists and Marxists. We just didn't. Do not comply. And get it set in your minds right now. And there are a lot of, I've spoken privately with a lot of law enforcement. They're not going to enforce anything like this. So there's a lot of people that believe this way. They just aren't saying it publicly. But I am. On the local front, and last, Sean Vestal, once again, more comes out with a statement that says he was concerned about the accuracy of my post, exposing his ties to the Communist Party USA and also his ties to the Council of American Islamic Relations, which was found, as a matter of fact, in law in the Holy Land Foundation trial by a federal district court judge to be a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, he said he was concerned with the accuracy of the article because he didn't give money to the Peace Justice Action League. Well, that's not what I said in the article, and that's how these guys do this disinformation. What I said was he's a donor, and he's listed as a donor on their website at their Bread and Roses dinner auction. And by the way, as a legal matter, anytime you do make a donation, and it does have to be given a monetary value for tax purposes later, but I digress. Once again, exposing the left, and that's the briefing. Remember, the antidote to dependency and socialism is to be a God-fearing, self-reliant, freedom-loving American. Thank you to everybody that has been praying for me and Victoria and praying for the show. And if you get a chance, go to Facebook.com/Patriot Radio US, like the page, share it with your friends and family, and help spread the word of freedom and liberty throughout not only the American readout, but the entire Western United States, and hopefully the entire world, because there are some listeners we have in Germany and Romania. I love it. So all you guys that are listening from outside the United States, send me a message on Facebook and let me know where you're listening from. I love that. Freedom doesn't have boundaries. It spreads all over the world. And if you want to support the show, please go to VoteShea.com, and you can donate there to help keep us on the air. Well, we're going to talk about property rights in great detail today. We're going to be talking specifically about this whole allotment issue and the way that the lands in the West have been managed. It's my pleasure to introduce everybody on this show to Dr. Angus McIntosh, who is the executive of the Range Allotment Owners Association. A little bit of a mouthful, but nonetheless very effective, and has been teaching a lot of people in the West about what their rights are. Dr. McIntosh, thank you very much for being on the show with me today.
Thank you for having me. It's a real honor.
Well, sir, I've been following your work and everything you've been doing. If you could, tell the listeners a little bit about the Range Allotment Owners Association and what that's about, why it started, and how you got involved in all of this.
Well, this is the first time that first let me start with explaining to your audience what a range allotment is, because a lot of people probably don't know. But in the Western United States, when Congress finally got around to granting land in the West as far as homesteads, when they got farther west, they found that 160, 320, 640 acres wasn't enough to support a family. And so beginning in the early 1900s, right around the turn of the century, Congress adopted a new policy called the unit policy. And what they would do is they would grant a homestead to a settler on land that was unusable for farming, but was chiefly valuable for grazing and raising forage crops. And they would grant a homestead. And then in addition to that, they would grant an additional entry, what was called an additional entry, or an additional amount of land as a grazing allotment. The United States retained the timber rights, the mineral rights, but granted the grazing rights to these ranchers on these grazing allotments. And a lot of this law has been forgotten over time. And so what we're trying to do is re-educate ranchers in general and the general public on the fact that these ranchers have property rights in the nature of a limited fee title in these grazing allotments. And there never has been an association of allotment owners in the West. There's been NCBA and there's been cattle growers associations, but in some states, some of these cattle growers associations, some of the members don't have grazing allotments, and some of them do. So this is the first association we've ever formed specifically to support the rights of allotment owners.
So how did you get personally involved in all of this? And I really want to hone down on the fact that, you know, a lot of people use the term federal land when really it's mixed-use land, because as you very well pointed out, that is a right that the federal government did not retain. They retained all the other rights, but they gave these ranchers the grazing rights, which is ownership in that property right. It's actually something tangible in that property right that is being ignored throughout the West, as if it's almost like they're being given a license or permission to be there, when in actuality it is something that is owned.
That's correct. And what got me really started was I actually worked for the federal government for 16 and a half years. The majority of that time was working for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the majority of the time I spent with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, I actually worked for the Forest Service as a range conservationist, and then for the Natural Resource Conservation Service as a rangeland management specialist. And during this time that I worked for the Forest Service, I learned that ranchers own these property rights. And I asked my boss one day, I said, wait a minute, if these ranchers own their allotments, then how can we make them do anything? How can we force them to accept the wolves that have been implanted on their allotments and things like this? And my boss said, you get them to sign something, then you got them. And to me, that just didn't seem right. What they were doing is taking advantage of the lack of knowledge that these ranchers have about their property rights. They had always assumed that these federal agencies and the federal employees would treat them fairly. What the ranchers fail to understand is a lot of people in these agencies, at least nowadays, they don't know all of these laws. They just take it for granted that the boss above them is telling them the truth. And so they tell a rancher, well, you have to do things this way, when in reality, they have a choice.
Well, that is so fundamental here. They don't realize they have a choice. They don't realize they have a choice, but also it seems like when some of these ranchers do exercise their choice in the property rights direction, that they suddenly come under this great big microscope of federal bureaucracy and sometimes even the court system. What do you advise ranchers to do in these situations when, you know, they're asked to sign something and then all of a sudden they do come under this microscope?
Well, where they lose most often and what they fail to understand is that words have meaning in the law. And if you are reading an act of Congress, and this is something you know and you understand, and this act of Congress refers to public lands, there is a legal definition of that term, public lands. And public lands for the first 200 years of our country was land open for entry and settlement upon which there are no rights or claims. This all changed in 1976 when Congress realized that there were no more public lands, that there was some kind of right attached to every parcel of federal land in the West, or it was withdrawn into some special reservation such as a national park or a national forest. Any of these kind of things takes that land out of this category of, quote, public land. So Congress redefined it in 1976 in the Federal Land Policy Management Act, redefined it as land or interest in land owned by the United States. So now an underlying mineral estate or timber rights became, quote, public land. So when a rancher gets taken into court, instead of arguing, wait a minute, I own the allotment, the grazing allotment, instead what happens is the agency will accuse them of illegally grazing on public land, and if they don't challenge that assertion and they go into court arguing over that, well, they're automatically going to lose. It would be the same as if, let's say, you own 100 acres of land and I have an easement across that. And one day you decide you want to stop me from using that, and so you take me into court claiming that I'm trespassing or that I'm illegally using your land. Now, if I argue that, well, I've hired an expert and they've done a study and they say I'm not hurting anything, no matter what argument I use, I'm going to lose until I point out, wait a minute, I have an easement. I have a property right. Now that makes out, instead of me being a trespasser, now it makes out a completely different argument. Now it is a property rights issue. And what happens is, because most ranchers don't understand the property rights that they have, cannot point to the specific statutes that Congress passed granting these rights, and even most attorneys don't know about these laws. But they're what they call black letter law. They're well established. There's Supreme Court precedent on this, but it's not well known. And so most of the time, ranchers lose. They hire the local attorney that specializes in DUIs or divorce cases, and he doesn't know anything about these kind of laws. And that's why most of the time the rancher loses.
And you're absolutely right, because once you've admitted it in court, then you're right, they have you over a barrel, 100%. So in 1976, I want to go back to this so it's clear for all the listeners. In 1976, they literally just changed the definition. And I try to tell people all the time, this is where at least I read the legislation that comes through. This is the first place I go is read the definitions, because that's usually where they try to get you, is in the definitions. So if you could, again, go over the difference between pre-1976 and public land definition and post-1976 public land definition.
Okay, what happened was Congress had ordered a public land commission study in 1964. They finally finished in 1970 and came back with this report to Congress saying, you know, there are no more public lands, lands that meet the specific definition of public land, because there is some kind of withdrawal or an easement or a right-of-way or a grazing allotment or water right or some kind of right-of-way attached to all the land in the West. And so technically there's no more public land. So Congress said, well, gee, we've got to change this. And so they now redefine public land to be, instead of being land upon which there are no rights or claims, they just simply changed it to land or interest in land that belongs to the United States. So now a retained mineral interest, a timber right, something that belongs to the United States. Now, the timber right itself meets the statutory definition of public land. So, you know, when they go into court and they assert that you're doing something illegal to public land, if you don't know that this is really a split estate or multiple use land that has, for example, I'll just give you an example. Every county road and every state highway that crosses federal land in the West and in the state of Washington has as a basis the Act of July 26, 1866, which was a statutory grant of right-of-ways. So if people understood that, then the local county commissioners, every time the Forest Service or the BLM shut down a road and the county knew that they had a legal grant of a right-of-way, which separated that county road from the underlying federal land, they could assert that right. But because they don't know that, we've all bought in to this fallacy of calling it public land, when by legal definition, there are no rights attached to public land. So that's what they've been able to accomplish. And when people say, oh, that's just semantics, no. You go into a court of law, and you better know the meaning of the words that you're arguing about, or you're going to lose. And that's what's happening. We haven't kept up on the law, the understanding of the law, how Congress granted all of these various split estate interests years ago, decades ago. But these federal agencies, after 1976, they understood, gee, we've got to do something. We've got to try to extinguish all of these property rights. So if they make life so miserable for the county and trying to maintain that road, they just give up. And they quit maintaining the road. Now the government argues, well, they just abandon it.
Abandon it. It should revert
back to us. And the same thing with the ranchers. If they make their lives so miserable by fencing off their stock water locations or fencing off their best grazing areas, and they get the rancher to just quit and walk away, now they can just claim, well, they abandoned their property rights. We didn't take it, and so therefore they don't know what their rights are, so they don't go to the court of claims and ask for compensation for the taking of their property. They just simply walk away not knowing that they have these property rights, and then these federal agencies just claim, well, they abandon it. It's like when they attached the $100 holding fee. Bruce Babbitt attached that $100 holding fee to mining claims. Now it suddenly made all of these thousands of mining claims in the West so uneconomical to maintain, people just left. They just abandoned them. And that's been their policy since 1976, trying to destroy private property interest under the guise that, oh, well, we're just improving it, or we're just making the public lands more accessible. When in reality, they're doing the exact opposite. Whenever they extinguish, for example, this remote mining claim that has a road going to it, when they get rid of the mining claim, now there is no legal requirement for them to allow that road to remain open, and so the federal agency shuts off that road. And that road is what guaranteed the public access to these federal lands.
It's insidious, isn't it? I mean, and I would like you to comment on this. Why do you think they're shutting all of these lands down? What do you think is the purpose behind this?
Well, the way it was put to me when I actually worked for the Forest Service, and I started to confront my superiors about my bosses about the fact that, hey, when you fence off this creek, you're denying that rancher the use of a water right. The way it was put to me is, hey, we've got jobs to protect. They're building a huge bureaucracy. For example, under the Endangered Species Act, if anyone has actually ever read the Endangered Species Act, they know that there are at least six previous iterations of the Endangered Species Act dating back to 1918. And in every one of those, it says that the federal government must get the permission of the state legislature before they establish any land areas, even within a national forest, for wildlife preservation and propagation, because that's a constitutional requirement. But these federal agencies, what they do is they just bank on the fact that nobody has ever read these laws. They interpret them the way they want to, and so then they get away with basically getting around the law, and they start creating all these wildlife management areas for endangered species, and that's just one way that they do it, and it's in order to protect their jobs.
A lot of people think that it can't be that simple. I mean, these people, maybe they just aren't educated enough on these things. I have always maintained that this has been intentional and it's been an agenda. And, I've uncovered maps, surrounding Turnbull Wildlife Refuge, for example, outside of Spokane, Washington, that shows individual parcels that they want to acquire over the next 10 years. And this is not just in Washington. This is all over the Western United States that they're doing this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's, they're just building a huge bureaucracy from the bureaucrat's perspective. I'll tell you, we used to own a ranch down in Arizona, and my wife's great uncle told me one time that when the first federal grazing official under the Taylor Grazing Act first showed up down there back in the 1930s, there was one guy and a secretary, and they were able to manage the whole area. Today, you drive by that same BLM office, and there's over 100 pickup trucks just in the parking lot. And there's got to be at least 200 employees working there. So the agenda has been to build this huge bureaucracy to create jobs that are, these people are tax consumers. I've heard the environmentalists refer to ranchers as welfare ranchers when the truth is it is all of these federal employees. They are 100% paid out of taxpayer dollars. On the other hand, the ranchers pay for all of their range improvements. This is a fallacy that's propagated by the environmentalists. They say, oh, the taxpayers are paying for all these range improvements. That's an absolute falsehood. That money comes straight out of what's called the Range Betterment Fund. 50% of all the money the ranchers pay in their grazing fees goes to pay for the range improvements. So the ranchers pay for the range improvements. 25% of what they pay in their grazing fees goes to pay federal employees' salaries, and the other 25% goes back to the county of origin for roads and schools. So the ranchers are paying. On the other hand, the people that work for these federal agencies are 100% taxpayer supported. On the other hand, the ranchers are actually producing, if they're loggers, they're producing wealth from the timber. If they're ranchers, they're producing calves. If they're miners, they're producing from the ground oil and gas and minerals. It is actually the federal employees that are the tax consumers. They are the welfare recipients.
I love the way you put that, and it's absolutely true. I want to shift gears very quickly, and for all the listeners out there, this is Matt Shea on Patriot Radio, speaking with Dr. Angus McIntosh of the Range Allotment Owners Association, RAO for short. There is a situation going on in the Dakotas right now, and specifically with the Dakota Access Pipeline. And there's big controversy over Indian treaties and Indian land. How does the allotment issue change, if it does at all, in regards to Indian lands? Because Indian land is technically a sovereign nation. How does it change there? And do you have any information on what's going on there up in North Dakota?
Well, I don't have any information specifically on North Dakota, except to say that this whole federal plan of land settlement actually began with the Indian Allotment Act of 1887. And what Congress wanted to do was to give to the head of every family and to each single person in a tribe their own land, to make them landowners, to be able to live the American dream. So it started by giving to each Indian who is a head of a household or an individual adult their own homestead plus an additional amount of land as a grazing allotment. So this whole concept of land settlement actually began on the Indian reservations, and then in the 1930s, they actually started to take those individual allotments away from the allotment owners, and then try to socialize the Indian reservations. And if you look at the state of the Indian reservations in the 1930s, they were thriving, they were producing, they were proud landowners. You know, they had their own allotments. They were managing their own herds. And afterwards, you look at what our Indian reservations look like today. They are the epitome of what socialism does to a country. They've actually destroyed the productive output of the people. They've taken away their pride of ownership, their individual rights, and they're trying to do the same thing with national forests and BLM grazing districts. And we have a Native American director. We have a director in each of the western states, and we have a Native American director to help Indian allotment owners. And so we're concerned about the rights of all people. Anyway, I don't know if that gives you any insight on what's going on in North Dakota. But, you know, that is a property issue as well, because every one of those Indian allotments that they're putting a pipeline through, you know, they have to take in consideration the improvements, the forage, and the water rights of those Indian allotment owners when they try to do that. And, you know, I'm not saying whether the pipeline is a good idea or not a good idea, but I am saying that, you know, whenever they do something like that and they don't take into consideration the cost and the effort that these allotment owners have put in to their ranch without giving them any compensation, that's an abridgment of a constitutional right, the right to be compensated for the taking of private property.
And that really is what this comes down to. And based on treaty, Native Americans have the exact same constitutional rights based on treaties that have already been signed. So that includes being compensated for your property being taken. And, you know, reading through some of what's going on there, it just seems like it's once again this kind of heavy-handed tactic of just thinking nobody's going to challenge them in the right way and we're just going to take it and to heck with everybody else. And that's kind of what we're seeing all over the West, because like you said, people don't know what their rights are. So if people want to get more information, they want to be able to contact you, find out more about your organization, where can they go on the web?
They can go to rangeallotmentowners.com. We have a website. We have a Facebook page. they can contact us. If there's any allotment owners out there listening to your program, we encourage them to join our association. Our goal is to, by the end of this year, to have 1,000 allotment owners west-wide. That will give us a huge, significant number of allotment owners that we can then be able to go to a congressman or a senator and say, hey, we represent 600 million acres of land in the West that's used for livestock production, and you know, we want to have your help in trying to protect the rights of these producing Americans who are producing, you know, a product, an American product, a healthy livestock here in the United States.
Well, I really appreciate all the work that you're doing. In the last couple minutes that we have, what do you think are some steps people can take locally, besides joining your organization, they can take locally to fight back on some of this stuff? Because a lot of people ask me all the time, well, what's the solution? We know they're wrong. How do we fight back? How would you respond to that?
Well, I think education is one of the primary goals of our association, to educate allotment owners on what their property rights are and what all these laws are. And what I found out over time is that even the general public doesn't understand how important it is for their access to keep these ranchers out on the land. Because as long as that rancher is out there on that allotment, these federal agencies cannot shut down the public access. And some people might call these environmental groups useful idiots. They're being used by the globalists to try to shut down American production, try to destroy American ownership. You know, if you want to look at it this way, you've got a small number of people producing in agriculture in the United States, 2%. And of that 2%, maybe a half of that, less than a half, maybe a quarter of that number are Western ranchers. And so they control a huge amount of land, 600 million acres. And if the environmentalists and the globalists can exterminate or get rid of all of these Western ranchers, now you've got 600 million acres of land that the globalists can lay claim to in a socialistic manner. The goal of our founders was never to have a country made up of little communist states where the state or the federal government owns all the land and the people are merely serfs. It was intended to be a nation of property owners so that people could produce and could contribute to the economy and be proud owners of real property. And so people need to educate themselves on this and understand that by keeping these ranchers out there, it keeps these public roads open. It keeps the access available.
And I think a lot of people
understand.
I think a lot of people miss that fact. And I hear, you know, the counter argument is, you know, aside from, you know, people that want the management of lands to be returned to the states, where I believe, based on the Enabling Acts, especially Washington, Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota, you know, people say, well, you just want to steal the national parks. You want to close land down and close off access, when in fact it's exactly the opposite.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people, I used to be in that camp, you know, return the public lands to the state, until I realized that there are already hundreds of millions of acres of land that have various private property rights attached. And my only fear in that movement to return the land to the states is that these people's property rights will be trampled in the process. And, you know, the only thing I, you know, just want to try to do is educate people on the fact that when Congress, for example, passed the Stock-Raising Homestead Act, they granted a legal, limited title to the rancher for ranching, and the federal government retained basically the mineral estate and the commercial timber rights. And so those are the things that I think need to be turned over to the state, is those mineral rights. That's where the greatest wealth is in these western split estate lands. Have those mineral rights returned to the states. When you look at a lot of this legislation that the states are passing, they're saying, okay, we'll let the United States keep the mineral rights. Well, that's the biggest part of the value.
That's exactly right.
Go back to the states.
That's exactly right. Well, Dr. McIntosh, I really appreciate you being on the show today. We've run out of time, but I want to have you on again and go through a lot more of this. And I know there are some ranchers that do listen to Patriot Radio that I am sure are going to want to be a part of your association. So thank you once again, and God bless, and keep up the fight.
Thank you, sir.
Dr. Angus McIntosh, Executive Director, Range Allotment Owners Association, and also, as you heard, just a very clear, well-thought, simple approach that these are property rights, that they're owned, and that we need to preserve them if we actually want to preserve the republic, because literally every dollar comes out of the ground or the air or the water, and when they try to shut off our ability to produce wealth, they shut off our ability to fight tyranny. And that's really kind of the insidious nature of what's going on. And by the way, the BLM has 10,000 employees. He was mentioning how many employees? 10,000. Well, this is Matt Shea. Thank you very much for joining me on Patriot Radio today. May God bless all of you, and may he make this generation the greatest one.